Stu Does America.
Get all the 2024 election updates you could possibly need with my free audio podcast series, State of the Race. It's available now under the Stu Does America stream, wherever you get your podcast. New episode coming tomorrow. We're going to be diving into a bunch of deep polling stuff, kind of setting the tone as to where we are in the 2024 election at this moment, and we'll be updating that as, of course, as we get closer and closer even more often. Be sure to check out the show on YouTube. It's youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. We've got new comedy videos up there as well, plus like and follow. And I mean, just take a second right now. Just follow the show. Just do that right now. I'll just wait here, and you just click that little like button. Maybe click the little bell, too, for notifications. Go ahead. Just do it real quick. Okay, thank you so much. John Daniel Davidson is going to be here to talk about what the decline of Christianity means for American culture. I will break down the new woke rules regarding transgendered actors in Hollywood. It's very hard to follow, but perhaps you can do it. We're going to start, though, by doing Biden's Israel backpedal. And I don't know. I mean, what we're talking about is maybe even something more severe than that. But I want to set the tone first, or the background of where we are. If you go back to October 7th, of course, Hamas attacks Israel. And we're on the air, I don't know, October 7th, October 8th, whenever that next show was, talking about how, hey, guys, this feels like the world is outraged right now. And it's true. It felt that way for the initial hours afterward. But in just a couple of days, a couple of weeks, you're going to see the world turn against Israel. They're going to switch. They're going to forget all the horrible things that we saw on video. They're going to forget about all the bodies murdered in the streets. They're going to forget about all the disgusting things that happened on October 7th. And it's in the underlying current of the world and where it's heading right now is going to wind up turning on Israel. Of course, we went through this period where it became relatively obvious relatively quickly. We talked about a vote in December, I think it was, for the United Nations voting on, to condemn Israel and or not. And the vote was 150 to 10 in favor of condemning Israel, with the United States, of course, as they usually do, there to block the condemnation. Of course, that kept changing. And over the weeks, we saw all of a sudden the United States abstaining from this. And we started seeing calls for a ceasefire from the far, far left. Of course, this was associated with riots and protests at colleges, all sorts of anti-Semitism, people saying terrible things to random Jews walking down the street. It really turned ugly and continues to be ugly. And it's only, honestly, become more and more, stomach turning. Why? Well, Israel has done what they said they would do. They said they would go into Gaza. They said they would go after Hamas. Something like, you know, we've heard estimates of about 70% of Hamas being taken out so far, but that leaves 30% left. That's a big, big chunk when you're talking about terrorists living next door. So, without surprise, they realize they need to go into places like Rafah to make sure that the people who are in Hamas, who are hiding there, no longer have an opportunity to pick their hiding spot because they're dead. That is the basic goal, captured or dead, of all these Hamas people. Now, of course, as wars tend to be, it's messy. You know, I mean, you have a very narrow, dense area where a lot of people are, and Hamas is, of course, hiding among citizens intentionally. We know that's happening. We've seen tons and tons of videos supporting it. We have known this for many, many years. In fact, at times, Hamas has even bragged about it. They've said how they are not only hiding among the people, they are, you know, they are experts at hiding in tunnels. They have they've pulled up water pipes given to them to get water to their people, and instead use them as rocket launchers. These are the types of things and people that Hamas are. Okay. That is something that the world used to know before October 7th and seemingly have forgotten. Throughout this time, though, there was a bit of tension going on, and there was a pull and push between the hard left, which is, you know, the AOCs, the Ilhan Omars, the Rashida Tlaibs of the world, pushing Joe Biden, calling him Genocide Joe at times, trying to get him to call out Israel and say, hey, you need a ceasefire right away. What you're doing is wrong. And the Biden administration, who, you know, look, I would certainly never classify them as pro-Israel, but at least occasionally they would say the right things. They were helping with some arms sales. They were somewhat supportive at times, certainly more than Rashida Tlaib wants. You know, Rashida Tlaib seems to want Hamas control of not only Gaza, but maybe the entire world. So there's going to be some sort of conflict there. And as we talked about, and you've pointed this out, and I know in your comments as well, when we talked about Israel, over time, it was clear Joe Biden would crumble. He does not have a real foundation, Joe Biden. He's the type of guy that has found himself right dead center in the middle of the Democratic Party, basically for 50 years, despite the fact that it has changed dramatically in that time period. He's always sort of found himself right in the middle politically of the Democratic Party. Not too liberal, but not too conservative for the people around him. Well, of course, Joe Biden is now crumbling and is happening day by day. Now, this comes in the heels of some real tragedy in this region and some real alarm. There was, a group of volunteers who were trying to provide food for the people in Gaza from a pretty good organization that is, you know, helping also in places like Ukraine to help people who need food. And there was an attack that from Israel that wound up killing seven of them. They, of course, apologized for this. They say it was a mistake. Of course, they're doing an investigation to see if there's anything more. Everyone, of course, immediately jumps to blaming them because, you know, they just wanted to wipe out a bunch of chefs or something in the middle of Gaza. I mean, the odd conspiracy theories tied to that one we may never have a chance to get to, but trust me when I say that they're bizarre. So you get down the line here, and then you have, of course, the attack by Israel in Syria. And now Israel is beefing up their air defenses, calling for troops as Iran payback for Syria strike looms. Now, they took out a bunch of commanders there. Of course, they are aiding Hamas, have been aiding Hamas for as long as anyone can remember. And these attacks have, while completely justified in my mind, have brought even more criticism of Israel. Now, of course, add on the fact that there was the tragic mistake with the aid group in Gaza, and you get a situation where times are a little tense. And that was the idea going into today. Today, we have a call between President Biden and Bibi Netanyahu. Now, this is on the heels of, you know, Israel saying, we're not going to send our people. We don't think you're really, helping us out here. Biden has, you know, sent arms and maybe said maybe we won't in certain circumstances. And of course, the temperature going into today, very hot. White House temperature, very high ahead of the Biden-Bibi call. And of course, it's not just the things we hear about, right? We all know what's going on in front of the cameras and in front of the news desks. We don't know what's going on behind the cameras, what's going on in the Oval Office, what's going on in the White House bedroom when things go dark at night. And there's a lot of things I don't want to think about. Biden's been talking a lot about his sex life lately. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Jill Biden. Stop it now. Jill Biden privately urges an end to the conflict in Gaza. President recounted the First Lady's concerns as he was pressed about the war at a meeting with Muslim community members. This is the stuff going on behind the scenes. Now he's getting pressure from his wife to get a ceasefire. He's getting pressure from the left. He's getting pressure from his wife. He's getting pressure from all sorts of places all over the world. Will he have the backbone of, let's say, a John Fetterman? I can't even believe I'm saying that. And hold his position, at least kind of. I mean, I don't think his position has been that strong the whole time, but at least hold somewhat of a neutral position in this case. And we've seen this situation happen over and over and over and over again with Biden. When he has an opportunity to either reach out to independent voters or moderate voters that he might be able to win over to vote for him, or a chance to reach over to his crazy base and to say, hey, we love you, AOC. We love you, Ilhan Omar. We love you, Rashida Tlaib, and all your followers. In almost all circumstances, he's chosen to go to the left. He's chosen to go to his base over and over again. Well, today, kind of a big deal. Because this is the United States and Israel we're talking about. Now, I know you could talk about Great Britain for sure, but we're talking about our closest allies. Israel is certainly near the top of the list. We are the only reason, probably, that they still exist when it comes to at least earthly reasons. And that is a big, big deal. Abandoning Israel would be really, really bad. We called the show today Biden's Israel backpedal, and it is a backpedal. But it is an abandonment, and that abandonment has started in real terms today. President Biden spoke by telephone with Prime Minister Netanyahu. This is from the White House. The two leaders discussed the situation in Gaza. President Biden emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. Think about what that means. That sounds fine, right? We all want innocent Palestinians to be okay, to get food, to not be killed by bombs. We're all on the same page on that one. Of course, it's a war, and you're telling Israel, an ally, we are going to dictate the terms of your war. Not you. We'll do that for you. We will make sure you do what we say you're going to do. That's not really our job. Now, of course, Israel does depend on aid from the United States. I don't know if they necessarily 100% need it, but they certainly appreciate it quite a bit. And, you know, because Israel is pretty good at defending themselves, even if we're not around. However, that being said, this is an out-and-out threat to Israel. We are going to pull the money away from you if you do not do what we say. Anyone with the idea that this is a pro-Israel administration has to be cured of that ailment at this point. Whatever condition you have to think that this is a pro-Israel administration, take yet another pill, because that has to be cured immediately, or you're in serious mental danger. The White House continues, Biden underscored that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and to protect innocent civilians. And he urged the prime minister to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home. You know, there's been, and this is coming from Joe Biden, by the way, there has been, and Corinne Jean-Pierre, there has been a deal on the table to get the hostages back home. For a long time. You know what they're waiting for? Hamas to agree to it. That's what they're waiting for. The ceasefire would exist already if Hamas agreed to the ceasefire. This is not a situation where Israel is not wanting a ceasefire. They do want a ceasefire, but they want the ceasefire on the terms that Hamas goes away and the actual hostages are returned. That's what they want. You know who's not agreeing to that? Hamas. Now, they might say correctly that, hey, once we give back all these hostages, we have no leverage. It's probably true because, you know, Israel's been really quite clear that once we're not going to stop until Hamas is eliminated. We're not going to say, OK, well, you guys are OK. You're back in power. No. They must continue. They cannot stop because this is going to happen to their people yet again. The two leaders also discussed public Iranian threats against Israel and the Israeli people. President Biden made clear that the United States strongly supports Israel in the face of those threats. Now, yeah, we're fine in defending you against Israel, but when we're talking about the people who actually came across the wall there and murdered a bunch of your people, that one we're a little more iffy on at this point. You know, we gave you a few months. It's all we can give, apparently. Biden calls for immediate ceasefire in Gaza in call with Israel's Netanyahu. President Biden called Thursday for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during a phone conversation with Netanyahu, the White House said, days after the killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza unlocked a firestorm of global criticism over Israel's conduct in the war. By the way, that's criticism for that particular incident, also from Israel. Israel itself is saying this is a terrible thing. We wish this didn't happen. We're going to do a full investigation, but this was a terrible mistake, and it was not Then why would you be targeting aid workers? It doesn't make any sense. Netanyahu and other Israeli officials have rushed to apologize for the deadly strike on the World Central Kitchen and Convoy Monday. But the White House and the group's founder, Jose Andreas, are intensifying pressure on Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza and to take steps to safeguard non-combatants. The White House said that Biden and Netanyahu discussed the latest developments in Israel and Gaza. Again, this is always Israel's responsibility. Like, they were the ones that were attacked, but it's also their responsibility to protect all the communities that brought the attackers to their territory. I don't know why that is. I don't know why we need to be involved in the aid at all. I've talked about this before. That vote that happened in December was 150-10, meaning there's 150 countries that are absolutely fine in condemning Israel. And the 150 countries, by the way, came together to condemn Israel and also resisted an amendment brought up by Austria that said, hey, shouldn't we condemn Hamas and for what they did? No. They said no. They said no. So I don't know what we're talking about here. These are not sane. They're not normal actors. These are not people you can negotiate with. And the idea that 150 countries can't come together, if they hate Israel so much, maybe they pay for the aid. How about that? Maybe they're responsible for it. Maybe they come to the table and they deal with it for once. Maybe we're not the ones that deal with every single problem, I don't know, one time. How about that? You know, we're supposed to be allies with Israel. We're the ones bringing all the aid. And a bunch of these other countries are just sitting back being like, yeah, gosh, those Jews are bad, aren't they? And doing nothing. It's important to note. Now, it's also important to note that it's an interesting political dynamic, because you have on one side Joe Biden abandoning Israel. The Trump side of this, he's not particularly strong on this one either. He's not particularly passionate about this issue, even though he's done a lot, and a lot that has been ignored, honestly, by the media. I mean, his work during his administration for Israel, I think, was really important and probably his greatest accomplishment while in office. This is from the New York Times. Donald Trump again urged Israel to end the war in Gaza as soon as possible, repeating comments that have alarmed some Republicans because they are seen as undercutting Israel's right-wing prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Get it over with, Trump said on Hugh Hewitt's talk radio show, adding that, quote, I'm not sure I'm loving the way that they're doing it, and that, quote, Israel is absolutely losing the PR war. Now, I don't think I would disagree with the PR war situation from an analyst perspective. You know, of course, Donald Trump is more than that. He's a former president and a current nominee. And it does, of course, at some level, undercut what Israel is trying to do. I mean, just think of it from their perspective for a second. They have no allies left. You know, I mean, there's really just nobody left who is allowing these people to go and fight their own battles, which is what they should be able to do. The truth is, they were the ones attacked on October 7th. The fact that they want to respond and wipe out a Hamas is something that would absolutely relate to any nation that it occurred to. I mean, if you go back to our opinion after September 11th, when a much smaller percentage of our population was wiped out, what did we do? You know, we had Dave Marcus on a couple of weeks ago. He saw all the gruesome footage from the ground of October 7th. He saw the footage of all the terrible things that happened to women and children. And he said, if that happened to America, there'd be a million people dead somewhere. Whoever was responsible for it would pay endlessly for that type of action against America. And they should. That's exactly what should happen. You do something like that is such, so inhuman, you should pay an incredible, immeasurable price. The fact that Israel is trying to do that to Hamas is not something the American people or the rest of the world should abandon them on. But that is exactly what happens. And this is, of course, part of an administration that has been a complete catastrophe from minute one when it comes to foreign affairs. There's a new report out. This is a CNN exclusive. State Department officials told House investigators they created Afghanistan withdrawal plans from scratch. And you'd say, well, that What does that mean? I mean, it doesn't sound all that bad. Well, you saw how bad Afghanistan was. The quotes inside are unbelievable. Hours of closed-door testimony from three top State Department officials shed new light on the unprecedented situation in the final days of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, as the officials were rushed to the country with virtually no time to prepare and no established emergency evacuation plan in place when they arrived. That is absolutely inexcusable. It is disqualifying for a president of the United States to have, with months and months of notice, remember they kept blaming Trump for this. Actually, it was Trump's timeline. That was their argument. They knew this date was coming up. They knew this timeline was coming up, and they had literally nothing prepared. This comes from the people that Joe Biden selected to put on the ground to bail him out and figure something out to get people out of the country. The three officials, John Bass, Jim DeHart, Jane Howell, were all plucked from unrelated assignments and rushed into Afghanistan in the hours after Kabul fell to the Taliban due to their extensive experience in Afghanistan. Even Mark Milley said the decision came too late. Howell said, "I cannot emphasize enough to you that minute to minute, what was happening was changing." Bass expanded on this. "We were already in the midst of executing an evacuation that substantially exceeded, I think, the scope and scale of what had been contemplated." They didn't even contemplate what they were doing before they started doing it. That is completely disqualifying. I go back to this over and over again, but this is like, if nothing else occurred in this man's administration, if there was no inflation and everything else went swimmingly, just Afghanistan is enough to get this guy out of office. He should have been impeached over it. It's one of the most disgraceful actions that any U.S. president has ever been participant in. And he was doing it on the fly in the hours after the Capitol fell. Completely disqualifying from beginning to end. Well, no matter where you are, no matter what you're thinking, you see the United States of America these days, you want to be prepared for what might be around the corner. My Patriot Supply is here to help you with this. They help me and my family with this. Since 2008, My Patriot Supply has helped millions of Americans and their families prepare for an uncertain future. Many of them choose the three-month emergency food kits. This I like because it's 22 food and drink options. There's never going to be any food boredom if you ever have to use it. 2,000 calories a day. There's not going to be any starvation. You don't have to worry about that. Inside of ultra-durable, four-layer packaging, these ready-hour meals last up to 25 years in storage. So you do this once. You don't have to do it every year. You have to do it every 5 years. They last up to 25 years in storage. You will be prepared for, 99% of anything that can happen. I mean, 3 months will get you through almost anything, at least, unless we're in zombie apocalypse land. Then, My Patriot Supply can take care of you in zombie apocalypse land, too. They've got all the options you might need. Stock up on the food kits your family needs at the website preparewithstew.com. You'll get each kit for over $200 off. Protect yourself, protect your people at preparewithstew.com. Preparewithstew.com. They ship fast and free. It's preparewithstew.com. I'm happy to welcome John Daniel Davidson to the program. He's a senior editor for The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come, which is available now wherever you get your books. And John, you're challenging Glenn Beck for the darkest book titles. I like it. This is a fascinating book, and it's a scary picture, though.
Yeah.
You worked on this for, over a year.
Better part of a year, yeah.
Let's start here. Why did you write this book?
Well, the genesis of the book was actually me going to see the movie The Northman. I don't know if you saw that movie. It's a Viking Age revenge epic that depicts pre-Christian Northern Europe, like the Norse, pagan culture, in a really realistic and gritty way. And I think the filmmaker makes an unintentional argument in favor of Christianity by showing how brutal the pagan world was, how absolutely violent. It was a world where might made right, you know, and women and children and slaves counted for nothing. And it really impressed on me this idea that, you know, paganism was a bad thing. And and the Catholic Church and Christian civilization got us out of it. And that happened all over the world. Wherever Christianity spread, it broke the power of the pagan ethos over peoples and civilizations. And I started thinking about how we're entering a post-Christian era right now in the West, and our civilization that has been built on Christian ideals and Christian principles and Christian theological claims about what man is and what God is and how we should order society, that's beginning to go away. And as a post-Christian society, we need to be ready for the fact that all of the good things that we got from Christianity, those are going to go away too, and we're going to be left with a new form of paganism.
That's terrifying. I mean, you start the book kind of outlining how dark that period was back in the day. Mm-hmm. Not something I think any of us want to return to.
No.
But, and I don't know, you say the word post-Christian society, it hits me very strange. Like, I don't want to admit that, frankly.
Right.
I don't want to admit that that's true. I really hope that somehow we can save it from being true. But you argue that this has really fallen apart over the past few decades. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of walk us through how that happened?
Yeah. You know, all the indicators, when you look at church attendance, when you look at church membership, frequency of worship, and even the quality of a lot of the Christian faith that we have in America, has been in precipitous decline that began in the middle of the last century, the sexual revolution, the liberalizing of the mainline Protestant churches, and the increasing secularization of society really induced a free fall in church attendance and church membership in the United States. And that has continued and accelerated. Talk about the rise of the nuns, those who, N-O-N-E-S, who don't affiliate with any religion, mm-hmm. but will be a majority if current trends continue in the United States, you know, within the next generation or two, which means Christians will be in the minority, which has sort of never been the case in this country. And we're really looking at a future in which Christianity is a minority religion, and the public square and public life is no longer shaped and influenced by Christian ideals. And when that happens, I think that we can start to see things that came from Christianity, like freedom of speech, you know, rule of law, consent of the governed, things that require to make sense a Christian worldview. Those things will begin to go away, and I think they're already starting to go away.
Yeah, I think you're definitely seeing that signs of that culturally. Some would argue that we've obviously seen the improvement from the bad old days, but some would argue it's not necessarily Christianity. I mean, Steven Pinker wrote a book about this and argued, you know, for largely from a secular perspective, documenting the same sort of transition,
right,
which is a transition I think secular or religious we can all appreciate. How do you know that it had anything to do with Christianity? Couldn't it have been just people just getting more enlightened?
Yeah, right. Well, with apologies to Steven Pinker, I think he's wrong, right? And I'm not the only one. I didn't come up with this argument. I'm just trying to connect some dots here. There's another historian who wrote a great book called Dominion in 2019, a guy named Tom Holland. Really well done book that chronicles how the West and Western civilization really is based on Christian ideals. You don't get things like human rights or freedom of speech or freedom of religion just from pure, you know, enlightenment, divorced from any religious claims about what human nature is and what the cosmos is and what our obligations are to one another. And so I think, you know, to suppose that you can have Christian civilization or Western civilization just with no religion at all, you know, just with Enlightenment ideals divorced from any source of claims, fundamental theological claims about God and human nature, is totally wrong. And I think by looking at what paganism was and what the pagan, you know, moral order was, you can see that more clearly. For example, the pagan world was based on force and coercion. Mm-hmm. If my group was stronger than your group, it was our duty. In fact, it was like our moral obligation to go take what you had for our people. Because if all people are not created in the image of God, if all people don't have inherent dignity and worth, if they don't have inherent rights because they're God's creatures, then there's nothing to stop me. In fact, I should go, you know, pillage your village and rob you and enslave you and kill you if I need to or if I want to, if I have the power. And so that's the kind of societies that we saw before the Christian era, were ones that were based on force and coercion.
It's one of the amazing things about how many in the left, the media, will make arguments about how racism is tied to Christianity. Like, as you just point out, it must be the exact opposite.
Yes. Right?
It must be.
Yes.
If you believe in the Bible, it must be the exact opposite. Yet they keep bringing this up over and over again, trying to charge all Christians as being racist. Is this just part of the sort of the attack on Christianity generally to sort of weaken that foundation so they can implement all the things you're talking about?
Yeah, well, look at what the people who accuse Christianity of racist are saying that they would like to put in place, right? Mm-hmm. They would like to put equity and critical race theory in the place of that, which are just fancy words for a racist ideology that looks at people and says, you know, your race is the most essentially important thing about you. Mm-hmm. Where Christianity has always said that race is an incidental feature, and that the brotherhood of all humanity means that all races are equal in the eyes of God. They're equal before God. And that has been true. That's not like a recent invention of Christianity. That's been true since the beginning. It was one of the appeals of Christianity in the Roman Empire, right? Was that the religion that conferred inherent dignity on every person. Mm. And so it spread on that basis, and not by force, which is how pagan empires have always spread, by coercion, by force of arms. I think these attacks on Christianity are coming because we are entering into a post-Christian era where we don't there doesn't have to be this deference to Christian ideals anymore. And so you're seeing a new boldness on the part of critical race theorists who deny the Christian view of race in favor of what is essentially a racist view, but also in things like transgender ideology that deny basic biological facts, that the givenness of the created order, and pose what is a very neo-pagan idea that we can sort of create ourselves, and by our own will, a man can become a woman, or the opposite. Mm.
Another example you use in the book is abortion.
Yes.
And it does seem like we've gone down this road. I feel like politics and political types will often throw out terms like, culture of death. Mm-hmm. And it seems, in a way, almost just like a political insult to get you through an argument.
Uh-huh.
But like, you make the case that, I don't know, it seems pretty central to the entire movement.
Yes, and the key thing about abortion, and I go through this in the book, is that the justifications for it have changed since Roe versus Wade. Mm. The initial justification was, it's not the taking of a human life. It's just a clump of cells. It's no different than getting an appendectomy. Mm-hmm. We're not killing anyone here. Advances in medical technology quickly rendered that argument completely untenable, right? And so then in the 90s, it became, we're not going to talk about the humanity of these unborn children, but let's just make sure abortion is safe, legal, and rare.
Rare.
Bill Clinton's phrase,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's kind of paper over kind of the reality of it. And now you have a totally different justification that doesn't even pretend to engage with the science and the medical technology and the reality that these are human beings, right? Instead, you have this shout your abortion movement where abortion is said to be a positive good and necessary for the liberation and equality of women, right? And so you have these insane scenarios where children of the same gestational age in one state can be killed with impunity, but in another state, if the mother wants to keep the child, all the medical technology in the world has to be brought to bear to save that child's life. And the only thing that determines the humanity is the will of the mother, who is the one with power in this situation. It's will and force, which is very pagan.
It's scary, too. When you think about how I remember going back to, who was the doctor, the quote unquote doctor in Philadelphia who mm-hmm. did have all abortionists and had also wound up going to prison, essentially.
Kermit Gosnell.
Gosnell. That's right. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I remember thinking, like, there's a weird line here. So many of the children he, wound up killing were at 24, 25,
yeah.
26 weeks. And there was this line that if he had moved his schedule forward a month, he's a hero.
Right.
He's not going to prison. He's a hero. He's the guy that goes on probably a bunch of talk shows and talks about all the important things he's doing for inner city communities.
How brave he is.
Yeah. I mean, how does a society without a foundation in Christianity navigate the waters of lines like that? I mean, it just seems completely arbitrary.
It is arbitrary. Again, you know, we're used to, as Christians who kind of are still living in the echoes of Christian civilization, we're used to things kind of cohering and making sense. Mm. And one reason for that is because reason and faith go together. You know, they're not in conflict, right? Pagan societies that are based on force and coercion don't have to cohere in the same way. And so one of the things you see in all pagan societies, and one of the things I argue that we're seeing more of now, is a disfigurement of reason, right?
Right.
And so you see that in the abortion debate. It makes no sense, right? Mm-hmm. If Gosnell had moved his schedule up, he would be a hero. It makes no sense to say that a man can become a woman and a woman can become a man. It makes no sense to say that children can consent to sterilization and double mastectomies and you know, hormone blockers. And yet, these are the arguments that are being made now, oftentimes in the name of science, with total disregard for actual science. And this is a feature of the pagan ethos that I discuss in the book.
That's a great book. And you do go through at the end an approach, though the approach, and we have about a minute left, but the approach is something we really must do, but also isn't like a short-term solution to this. It's not like we're turning this around in November.
No, and that's a key point. There's no politician that's going to save us. No, you're not going to have a presidential election cycle or a majority in Congress that's going to like fix this.
Right.
This is a generational problem. It took generations to get here. It'll take generations to get out. But we have to, the first step, and the reason really I wrote this book was to wake people up to what's happening. We have to accept that we're living in a post-Christian society, and we need to take steps now to preserve the faith, to strengthen it, and to be once again the force that breaks the power of a pagan empire in our own time. And that's the task at hand.
John Daniel Davidson, the new book is Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. It is available everywhere now. John, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate that.
Many of you are probably fans of Hunter Schafer. Many are probably not, but Hunter Schafer has gotten offered tons of trans roles. That's great. But I just don't want to do it or talk about it, Hunter Schafer says. I just want to be a girl and move on, says Hunter Schafer. Now, Hunter Schafer was a dude and now is telling us he's a woman. And it was an actor on Euphoria, the HBO show, as well as one of the Hunger Games sequels, maybe? I don't know. Apparently has a new movie out, and this is probably no coincidence. And the tone of this is interesting because we've been told over and over again, for example, a straight man cannot play the role of a gay man. That role has to go to an actual gay man. A person who is not in a wheelchair cannot play the role of someone who is in a wheelchair. That person has to go to someone who actually is in a wheelchair. From the last Wonka movie can't play an Oompa Loompa because that role should go to a little person, despite the fact that there aren't actually any Oompa Loompas. This is a breaking news story. Bottom line is you're not supposed to play things that you're not, okay? Now, Hunter Schafer now does not want any more trans roles, wants to play non-trans roles, and we're supposed to just accept that. Now, look, to me, Hunter Schafer can play whatever role Hunter Schafer is qualified to play. I don't know if they're a good actress or not. I have no idea if Hunter Schafer is a good actress or actor or whatever she is or he is. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. I've lost track of which one's real and which one isn't. The bottom line is, Hunter Schafer, play whatever role they want, whatever they can qualify for. But the left's ideology would tell you that they can't, right? Because if they do, they will then be, you know, appropriating someone's culture. But now I guess we're okay with that because Hunter Schafer is trans. Even though we're not now supposed to say that, Hunter Schafer just wants to be a girl and move on. So, I don't know, you figure it out. Also, I want to bring up Sage Steele real quick. Sage Steele hit this In a couple of interviews, has talked about her interviews with Joe Biden that she did. She says that was an interesting experience in its own right because it was so structured. And I was told, you will say every word that we write out and you will not deviate from the script. To the word, she says, every single question was scripted, gone over dozens of times by many editors and executives. Absolutely. I was on script and was told not to deviate. This was very much, this is what you will ask. This is how you will say it. No follow-ups. This went up to the fourth floor, where executives, the C-suite, the CEO, they all approved it. I think it's really heartbreaking to the people who love Joe Biden and say they truly care about him that they have allowed to get to this point. She points out that he didn't seem to know who she was, started telling a story and just kind of stopped in the middle of it. His voice trailed off and said, whatever. It's a harrowing tale of her interview with Joe Biden, and yet another revealing moment in the presidency of a complete failure. Remember back in the pandemic when the COVID was going on and we had no access to anything? It was crazy, right? Like, thank God we got past that and everything's fine now, right? Oh, wait, no? We're still facing drug and medical supply shortages in the United States. As of March, there were still 200 drug shortages here in the U.S. It looks like it might get a lot worse than, you know, quickly before it gets better. Healthcare experts have pointed to shortages, domestic production, and the Drug Supply Chain Security Act as trends to watch this year. You wouldn't think that things like this could happen in America, but they have been for years now. And that's why you need the Jace case. It provides 5 life-saving antibiotics for emergency use. All you have to do is fill out a simple form online, and you'll have it right there for you in case you need it. There are dozens of add-on options as well. They have EpiPens, they have ivermectin, they have all sorts of stuff. So Jace Medical is there to empower you to take care of your family's health. Take it into your own hands. Check them out today. Go to jacemedical.com and enter the code STU at checkout for a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at jacemedical.com. J-A-S-E medical.com. Hillary Clinton has been back in the news again recently. She was doing some talk show circuit and telling voters how dumb they were for not voting for her old decrepit candidate. Bill Clinton, her old decrepit husband, was still her husband, which is shocking. It has a new memoir coming out. So they're going to be in your face quite a bit over the next few months. This one's called Citizen, not Bill Clinton, An Erotic Life, which it should have been. But Citizen, and it's going to... This really exciting story is going to talk about his life after January 20th, 2001. How much is it going to focus on Jeffrey Epstein? Do we know? How many chapters on good old Jeff? You know, Jeff Epstein, the philanthropist. I'm concerned that he's going to do this entire book and not even mention his good old buddy Jeff. He's lied about how many times he flew with him. We eventually saw photos of one of the Epstein accusers massaging him. Isn't that something he should be asked about? Jim Garrity pointed out today, he's never been asked about it since all this stuff came out. Never been asked about it. Why? When he does this book tour, is someone going to bring up, look, like, what was going on there? You said you didn't really know the guy, but you flew with him 30 times, even then when you originally said it was only a couple of times? This is a very interesting story. I don't know what happened. I think everyone kind of just assumes, yeah, sure, Bill Clinton was diddling kids. I mean, that's kind of what I think people would assume. With some good reason, but I think at the very least, maybe a couple enterprising journalists, when he's doing his book tour, might, I don't know, bring this one up. All right, let me tell you about Jason Whitlock's Fearless Army and its annual roll call event. It's an all-day men's summit in Nashville, Tennessee. It invites believers to fellowship together across our superficial differences. Jason's partnered with John Rich is going to be there, country music star, of course. He'll be there. Glenn is going to be there, I think, as well. It's sponsored by Preborn. You've got Jason, you've got Glenn Beck, you've got Governor Mark Robinson, you've got Pastor E.W. Jackson, many, many more. FearlessArmyRollCall.com is the place to go to get your tickets. FearlessArmyRollCall.com. Reserve your spot today.